Last summer, I had the opportunity to sit down with a pilot named Brad Jansen. He flies aerial mapping around the U.S. for a company based in Florida. And I thought I knew something about aerial mapping and aerial surveying from the work I did in Alaska doing marine mammal surveys. And what I found out talking to Brad is that it's a much more diverse and large market than I thought it was. Still definitely a niche market, but there are a few companies that do it worldwide. Planes ranging from Cheyennes and light piston twins all the way up to Dash 8s. And I suspect there are even some single-engine surveys going on out there. I just haven't dug them up yet. So, yeah, last summer when I was sitting around waiting for a plane to take over to Africa, I sat down with Brad and we talked quite a bit about the aerial mapping industry and how it works and lifestyle involved with aerial mapping. Different from some other jobs, kind of goes in big chunks where you work for a month out in the field and then you're back home for quite a bit. So it can lead to a pretty good quality of home life. And it's a pretty interesting job, pretty involved with, for what they were doing, they're high altitude a lot of the times, and you're working closely with the techs in the back of the planes, where you've got some super high-end equipment to do the super high-resolution photos that they're taking. And boy, before I tell the whole story and get it all goofed up, I'm going to let you get on to the interview and hear what Brad has to say, because he knows a lot more about it than I do.
This is Aiden with Oddball Pilot. I'm sitting down with Brad Jansen. He's with Digital Aerial Solutions, and we're in Plant City, Florida, small airport just east of Tampa. Brad and I were doing some chatting on Oddball Pilot, and then we took that conversation over to the network, did a little more talking, and I was coming through town to ferry an airplane over to Africa and had a chance to sit down and talk with Brad about his career. His early career and his current career, which is he's the flight operations manager for an aerial survey company. They do photographic surveys around the U.S. So Brad, just to start off, when did you start, when did you get interested in flying? When did you first, you know, figure that's what you want to do for a living?
Well, it started pretty young. My father's a private pilot, and he always took me flying. And also, I grew up in Appleton, Wisconsin, which is stone's throw away from Oshkosh, which is the largest air show in the world is. So I got the bug really early. I went flying with my dad a lot, and it's just something I've always wanted to do.
Right.
Got into, flying with my dad. After that, I started when I was in high school. I worked on the line, the FBO, fueling airplanes. From there, I saved enough money to start taking flying lessons at the FBO. At that point, I was just getting ready to go to college, and I decided I was going to go to college, get a degree in aviation, and I ended up going to the University of North Dakota in Grand Forks, North Dakota, did all my flight ratings there, got commercial instrument multi out of there, and after I left, I graduated in 1994 from there.
And you got the University of North Dakota is one of the larger aviation colleges in the country, or aviation universities, and you actually get a four-year bachelor's degree.
Correct. Yeah.
Do you get a bachelor's? Is it in like aviation management?
They changed it now, but it's called aeronautical studies.
Okay.
It's with the College of Aviation, but you still take all the general requirements at the regular college.
Okay.
English, public speaking, all like computer classes and all that stuff.
Right.
So it's a full 4-year degree. It's like college degree.
And as well, you had to come out with your commercial instrument.
Yeah, commercial instrument multi was what my degree was. I didn't get my CFI there. It's kind of ran out of time.
Right.
And I had a job, wound up back home to be a CFI at FBO. I just had to get the training with them. So I ended up going to a smaller airport. I had it was a gravel runway back then. Got my CFI there. And after I did that, they kind of hired somebody else, but I didn't get that job. But flying was tough back then. This is 94. It was hard to get a job. You had to have a lot of hours to get a job. And getting the hours was tough, kind of like it is now, I'm sure.
It's just starting to switch, but no, I'm with you. It's 94 is when I was looking, and you're right. There were no jobs. 7,000-hour flight instructors who couldn't go to the commuters.
Yeah. And then I ended up getting a job at a local airport there in Appleton, working for an airline, a Comair, as a customer service agent, working on the ramp, selling tickets. Did that for a couple of years, and then I they promoted me through the company, through Comair, to be an aircraft dispatcher, which I thought was pretty neat, and I was kind of doing a career change thing.
Yeah.
And they paid me, I went down to Fort Lauderdale, did my training there for the dispatch, and it was a couple-week course. Graduated from that, went back to Cincinnati, worked at a dispatch office for wasn't that long, really about 3 or 4 months. Really, then I ended up getting a job as a dispatcher back in my hometown for Air Wisconsin Airlines. And after doing that for about 2 or 3 years, I said I still had the flying bug. I just was sitting behind a computer, and I just decided I could go back to flying. So I started flight instructing part-time while I was a dispatcher, and that made me want to go flying even more. So I ended up getting a, getting a job, basically my multi-time building job, with the company. I was based out in Seattle, Washington, Everett area, doing flying a Beechcraft Duchess for, it was called Airborne Signal Metering, where you have an FM tuning box in the airplane and a boom antenna, pretty big boom antenna off the back of the airplane, and you fly grids, GPS grids over cities, areas that have cable, this is for cable companies, looking for radio leaks on the cable lines. This is, it's an FCC, it was an FCC required test that these cable systems get flown over looking for leaks. Like, we've covered big cities like San Francisco, and to, I guess to for a cable guys have a handheld unit. Things have probably changed now, but they had a handheld unit, and to for them to go over a city tracing these leaks would take forever. So
they do it with
planes. We do the flyover. We send them a map showing where the hot spots were, because we'd be recording that data, and then they could drive out to them.
And that was in a Duchess out of Everett.
Duchess, yeah.
I see, we didn't get to this really. It's
The company was in Everett, but we were based out of Valparaiso, Indiana. We had two Duchesses there. They had another Duchess and a 210, I think, on the out of Everett. So we did East Coast, they did West Coast kind of flying. that year, I mean, I flew a lot. I was on the road for 270 days that year.
Oh, wow.
So I flew a lot.
Yeah. And you would fly, and you'd fly the plane to your next destination.
Yes.
And then you'd fly over the city.
My first trip was 90 days long.
Wow.
And back then, this is before 9/11, we were flying over these cities, say, San Francisco, Atlanta, at 1,500 feet AGL. mostly at night.
Just clear with ATC, and then you'd go.
We had maps. We'd send them. And basically, we had to fly low because we were getting these radio signals. And it had to be mostly at night because we had a part of our job, we had an FM, we had a modulator, like a little VCR. They'd plug into the cable system that would send our signal over all the wires, the same signal that we had tuned in on the airplane.
Okay.
So a lot of time we'd do it in the middle of the night because they had to take cable channel down, and they didn't want to do that
in the middle of the day.
And the company is still in business out of Jacksonville now. Still doing that kind of work, so I guess it's still out there.
And what was the name again?
The company I worked for was called Flight Track. The one down in Jacksonville, Florida, is called Martech Engineering. They're still doing it.
Interesting. They're all over the place.
Yeah.
But were you flying grid lines when you did
that? It was pretty basic. We set up a GPS grid. We had a start lat long and end lat long, and the GPS would set up a grid, and we would just fly it. That was autopilot flying the grid. What we're doing now. Now we have things that are more precise with maps.
Wow, and they hired fairly low time guys.
Well, I was low time. I had a couple hundred hours back then, and I ended up getting $1,700 a month engine out of that job.
That's pretty good.
So that was perfect, yeah.
And it paid enough, you made a living.
Yeah. I said it was back then, it was $100 a day. I was single and whatever. That's how I lived. It was on 270 days because I made $27,000 that year. Right?
Yeah, they pay your expenses.
Yeah, everything expenses were paid. I had a credit card with the company. From there, I went, that company was getting bought, and it was time to move on anyway. I ended up flying for Colgan Air on the East Coast, Beach 1900.
Yep,
did that for about, I think about 2 years, and that was great. It was fine. The pay was horrible, of course, but I knew what I was getting into. I wanted the IFR time on the East Coast, which was great.
Well, that's super busy. You're at the Northeast, or you're around that Boston. Mm-hmm. We were just talking about that Boston, Massachusetts. That's super busy airspace.
And that airplane didn't have an autopilot, so you're hand flying the whole thing.
Right.
It was a great experience. It was great. That was a really sharp IFR pilot when I got it.
That was back when the 1900 was like one of the big commuter planes. Now they're all RJs.
Yeah. That was before we. And then from there, I went. I left Colgan. I went to an airline in St. Louis, Trans-States, flying Embraer 145. And we went. I was in training, and we went through this. We did ground school first, and then we went to the sim. We had some time off. I had like a month off, then I went to the sim. Halfway through the sim, my whole class got furloughed. So I was out of work for a while, and ended up, from there, that's how I got into survey. Ended up, after sending tons of resumes out back then, I got a job at that company in Jacksonville, that Martech Engineering was telling me. They were starting a new aerial imagery firm, or division, and they hired me to, basically come in and set the whole whole thing up. I was the pilot and, you know, did everything except made the maps and all that. And that was a good job. And that was just all for, that was just the forestry industry. We didn't do anything but fly forestry, like basically clear cut areas of forest, new plantings. We had a couple different programs. And those we had a digital camera. It was a camera set up for agriculture, not like the cameras we have now, which are more imagery.
So that was, and the work is related to management, like forest resource management.
Yeah, it was all the pine plantations.
Okay.
For Midwest Vaco, International Paper, and Plum Creek, big company landowners that have all this, Weyerhaeuser, all these companies that have pine plantations. And
right.
we could fly over, like I said, we had a couple different programs. One where they did, when they first planted a bunch of seedlings, we'd fly over it and they could tell by, we had an infrared camera on there that they could tell the health by looking at infrared. And if it was bad, they'd just plow the whole field over and start over again. Because they knew in the long run what their trees, what they need.
Right, yeah.
Stuff
yeah.
like that. And then they'd do clear cut areas, you know, that a contractor would come in there and cut all the forest down. And then they'd want to see these areas, the dimensions, to make sure they're paying the guy what he did. Or he didn't do the wrong field or
right,
and all that
yeah,
stuff.
Because
so, yeah. what they used to have to do is have a guy run around the perimeter with a GPS to find, you know, that would take all day.
This point.
Yeah, and there's snakes out there and all that. So these guys, they say. So that was cool. I did that. That company unfortunately, that company didn't last either.
Right. That's typical aviation.
Yeah, well, what happened was we had a lot of work when we quit, but we didn't have work that paid a lot.
I mean, right.
The clear cut area was kind of like small. I was only over the area a couple seconds at a time taking pictures. And then you go to the next area. But that was to do that was to get the work, the bigger work.
Right.
The more, you know, longer flight lines and bigger areas of forest, we didn't really get a lot of that work. So that company went out.
And you have to do that work that doesn't pay. You got to do it for a year or two mm-hmm. before they start giving you
yeah.
the better work.
Yeah. And it never came around. We get a few here and there.
Yeah.
So, and then the guys, that company were really nice to me. They kind of kept me paid for a month or two until I found another job. And what happened was a company, I was in Jacksonville, a company in Orlando, another aerial mapping company, was looking at our airplanes because they had camera holes in them. There aren't too many airplanes around with camera holes in them.
Right.
It's a big conversion. We were talking about that, the cost. And then they found out that I was looking for a job and they needed a pilot. So as luck would have it, I ended up working for this company in Orlando called the Aerial Cartographics of America.
Huh.
They have a caravan and a Cessna 206, and they have some helicopters that they use for their mapping.
Wow.
They do a lot of Department of Transportation, smaller stuff, mostly around Florida. But I did that. That's how I really got into water mapping. These guys, this company has been in business since, I think, 73. So there's a lot of experienced people teaching me how to, you know, the business, teaching me
right.
how to do this stuff, and flying and all that. So.
That's pretty solid, too.
So that was good. So I learned from those guys. And as time would have with the economy, this was like back in 2009, I think, they ended up falling on hard times and we had a bunch of people off. And then they pulled me in the office and I was cut off. And we didn't do much work for a couple of months, so I was scrambling looking for a job. And then I ended up getting a job flying caravans for a company in, it's in Oregon, Watershed Sciences.
This point is out of, not Corvallis.
Corvallis in Portland. When basically, I lived in Florida. They would airline me to and from the airplane. I was 2 weeks on, 1 week off, basically. It was pretty nice.
Yeah.
And, we did Idaho. I did Idaho, mostly Oregon coast, that kind of stuff. They did their stuff. They had two caravans, and they did the LIDAR, which stands for light detection and ranging, which is a laser camera that does topographical maps.
That's the same cameras you have in your car.
Yeah, that's one that's built in the 421. It's the same, actually the same model, too. The same company, Leica.
Okay.
And they would just do, they said it's all out there was terrain mapping, a lot of the stuff. They did a lot of coastline stuff because everybody out there back then was, maybe they still are, afraid that the tsunami is going to come and wipe everybody out.
Right, yep, yep.
So there's a lot of that stuff. They do a lot of more, the Watershed Sciences was more environmental and cool stuff like fire planning, all those kind of neat things. They did a lot of river valleys and stuff. They did mountains. Like I was telling you, I mapped Glacier National Park. Terrain mapping, you're going up and down over the mountains all day long.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Kind of neat up there.
You probably don't know if you've got, what do they look for in a pilot? I mean, because a caravan's usually a lower time flying.
Yeah, they're,
your plane.
Yeah, I can pull their mins up. They always do an ad on the internet. They wanted a higher time person just because of the type of flying they're doing.
Right, low level.
Because it's low level and it was mountainous terrain most of the time. But also, it's another thing with survey, there's a couple different levels of survey. Like we were saying, there's these guys who do the Google Earth. They hire 500-hour pilots
That's
right. To fly 172s, to go low altitude, buzzing around.
Yeah.
The stuff that we do is more, you know, there's a lot more money at stake.
Higher
our
end.
Equipment's more expensive. The planes are the insurance on the planes is basically what it is. Like, you know, fly a Conquest, you got to have insurance companies don't want you have a lot of time.
Right.
So we don't,
right.
You don't hire a lot of low 10 guys. But back to Watershed Sciences, I think their minimums were probably, I can't remember, but it was 2,000 hours maybe, something like that. And they wanted
it's
some
still
turbine time. Yeah.
That's something I'm just sort of thinking of, like someone's progression. A lot of skydiving places now have turbines, have caravans,
sure.
So you could actually get a start there and move on to.
If you had caravan time, they'd probably hire you. I don't know what they've done recently. I haven't been there for a couple of years now. But
I might go by, swing by their office sometime in the future.
Yeah, it's pretty cool. Like they do have an office in Portland now, too, I do believe.
But yeah, and I go between Portland and Seattle all the time in my truck. so that's from there you ended up where you are now.
Because what happened, I worked for the Watershed Sciences, and they ended up, what happens, long story short, the leases changed hands, and they didn't need, I was the new hired pilot, and I was the low end, they didn't need that many pilots, so I got sent back. And then I ended up getting a job, that's where I am now, at Digital Area Solutions. That's how I ended where I am now.
Okay, and here you fly, you've got two 421s and a Conquest.
Yeah, two C-model 421s and a
441. Yeah, and the Conquest is a cool plane.
Yeah, it's a nice plane.
Yeah, we just went out and sat in the Conquest, and it feels just like every other Cessna twin, except it goes, 350 knots?
Yeah, well, over the ground. I mean, it's a 300-knot true airplane.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And so the work you do at Digital Area Solutions is, again, same flying grids with the LiDAR digital photography.
Yeah, we have two digital cameras and a LiDAR camera. We do larger-scale projects with these airplanes. Like, we'll do whole states. Like, this, we just spent, every summer we do a project called the National Agricultural Imagery Program. It's called NAIP. And,
so is that who you're actually contracting with?
Yeah. It was U.S. Department of Agriculture and U.S. Geological Service are our big clients. We do a lot of work for them. State governments, we do that. A lot of counties work. We do counties with larger projects. We don't, like I said, the NAEP program, usually what happens is they take 15 states a summer that they want to do and everybody bids on it. There's only two or three contractors thinking of doing it this year, or did it this year. And I flew just they want to do it in the growing season, so it's basically the summer. And just an example, on the Conquest this last summer, we flew Kentucky, Upper Peninsula Michigan, and 75% of South Dakota. And from June 12th to August 11th, I flew 175 hours.
Okay,
that was all mapped, all flying lines, pretty much.
So, and you're based in Tampa, but for those you obviously fly.
We're all based in Tampa. We fly out, and like I said, we don't really have a schedule. During the NAEP season, we try to keep a 30 on and 10 off.
Okay,
so we do that just for that long trip because it gets long. My first year, I did 95 days on the road. That was kind of. I don't like living in hotels that long, but
When you said you got a new daughter.
Yeah,
now,
daughter now, so it's different. But yeah, for the most part, we don't have a schedule. It just depends on the weather and when we get the jobs.
When the work's there, you go do it. Yeah.
And the other thing about mapping, which is interesting, it's kind of like an art. I mean, you can only fly for imagery. You can usually only fly between the sun is 30 degrees from the horizon to 30 degrees from the horizon. Usually about 95, basically. It's kind of a cushy job, right? But that's for imagery. The LiDAR, you can fly 24/7, just as long as you have no clouds between you and the ground.
Okay, so you could go up at midnight.
Yeah, you can go
up. You're just waiting for the clear skies.
Yeah,
then.
Yeah. And, so if you get the clouds, mostly the imagery we do, no clouds, so you have to have a clear day. And a lot of that NAEP stuff we did over the summer, that's at flight level 260, so it's got to be a really clear day.
Yeah, I was going to say, because I know this, Kentucky, Tennessee, it gets pretty hazy.
The good thing is that these cameras can shoot through the haze. Pretty much.
So that does so the humidity.
It's no cumulus pop clouds. That's what you kill your job.
Okay.
So we got the sun angle. You got the weather, and sometimes we do jobs along the coasts, or we did a job a couple of years ago in Savannah, the harbor, because they're trying to get bigger ships come in, and they wanted the imagery of all the harbor.
Oh, and the channel.
Yeah, and we do beach jobs for beach erosion. The tide has to be right.
Right.
So you got weather, you got sun angle, and then you have tide. So it can be, you can be there at the right time, the right place kind of thing. You got to wait for it and go do it. So, but for the most part of the year, our company, we're home a lot. We'll go on the rest of the part of the year. We might go for a week max on the road. do a job. And it all depends on the weather. Sometimes because our planes are fast, which is nice, so we can go somewhere and get back quick.
Right.
Which is nice.
How much do you work with, like we were just looking at 421, you've got the setup in the back for the I'm going to call them the observer,
the
back where they're kind of the operators, where they're managing the camera system. Like in the morning, like when you get up and decide what you're going to do, do you all meet together as a kind of a crew, get a cup of coffee?
Yeah, we do a briefing of what we're going to do. We go get the weather. Usually up to the pilots. I mean, the operators are usually people that don't really have much aviation experience.
Right, really. They're the tech people.
Yeah, so, you know, we determine the area. You know, we usually have a project area where we're going to. We determine what area looks clear.
Right.
A lot of times it's a guess because it's sometimes we're looking at a satellite at 8 o'clock in the morning and it's
build-ups are going to occur.
Well, you can't see it. It's too dark anyway. You can't really see. So it's good to look at. We have a lot of different weather sources we look at on the internet to determine what's going to happen. We can do point spreads, all that kind of stuff to see what the clouds are going to happen.
Because as soon as you take off, it's costing money. You probably bid a cost by the contract.
Yes.
So the company doesn't want to, you don't want to go fly for 3 hours.
It happens. You go up and sometimes get nothing, come back. Usually you can make a determination. If you're going to 26,000 feet, if you're like about 15,000 and you can see cloud, you go home.
Right, right. And as you were saying, the process is you've got these grid lines downloaded from a computer that the customer is giving you. And then you download that onto another, the disk that you put in the camera.
Yeah, they put in the actual system in the airplane. So we flight plan in the office.
Right.
And then we put it into the computer system on the airplane. So the flight plan there's a screen of the camera, the pilot has a screen up front on the yoke that will have the flight plan depicted on it. And I said, getting on and off the line it's like playing a video game.
Right.
And you gotta stay on the line. There's tolerances, you know.
But tight to the pretty
very,
tight tolerances.
Very tight.
Yeah.
Usually about, well, the one system we use, you don't want to be more than like 200 meters off center line. And the altitude hold is, you have a little leeway there because what happens is when they get the data back in the office, they can process it to a certain altitude, but you don't want to be 1,000 feet off.
Right.
You usually try to keep it within 100 feet.
Okay. And even that lateral deviation, when you're doing 350 knots across the ground, it doesn't take a lot to...
No, and that'll make, if you can get high and you're going fast, and you can picture this, the higher you get, the larger your swath is.
That's just what I was thinking, yeah.
So, yeah, the higher you get, the more, if you deviate, the more, you know... Like I said, our camera is called the push broom camera. So when you see it on the computer screen, when you pull up your line, it's going to be one solid strip, you know, up there.
Yeah.
It's just totally scanning the whole way up the line.
And
the other digital cameras, like I said, they're frames. It'll be like, you know, have like a frame going up.
Okay.
If it yaws, it goes a little bit this way, you know.
But it's not a video camera, so it's taking still photos as it goes.
No, it's a scanner. It's scanning.
Okay, so it is like a...
Yeah, the push broom, it's called the push broom. It's a Leica ADS-40. So there's two different kinds of digital cameras, the push boom and the frame. The frame is like a regular digital camera.
Right.
Bang, 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 bang.
Okay.
We're just going like that, like the LiDAR. And I can show you, there's a couple websites some companies have a little animation kind of shows like an airplane flying. You can kind of see it.
Right. So when they look at it, are they trying to pull still photos out of the continuous frames, or are they looking at a whole... Are they? I mean, just out of...
Well, look at the whole thing. They have to do. It's a quite... I mean, it might take, like, I don't have the actual numbers, but it takes probably three times as long to process the imagery in the office than it does
right.
fly.
Okay.
They do a lot of things. They try to get seams lined up and glare and all that stuff. They make everything look pretty, kind of like not real. You know?
Okay.
depending on what happens.
Here's how I kind of deviate when I get curious about things. Let's back up just a little bit. So when you've got your... You sit down in the morning, you've got your plan, you've got the computer, the grid line set out, and you submit to ATC basically what your plan is. You're up in the flight level, you can't just buzz around.
Yeah, no.
You've got to be on a flight plan and stay away from other traffic.
Yeah, the things we do for the bigger projects, like I said, in the summer, the NAEP program, we have a letter of authorization from the USGS from our we subcontract from another company, usually. We have a spreadsheet with all of our lat-long start stops, every flight line we're going to have, and we usually go out four or five whatever maps are for that area.
Uh-huh.
That gets faxed. We call the center usually a month in advance and get that to our contact in center. We deal with the military desk. The military desks and centers usually does all the mapping.
Ah, okay.
And so they have all of our stuff. We talk it over with them. And then when we get out on the road, actually on the job, we make a phone call every morning and talk to the people and tell them, here's what we're doing. We're doing lines 10 through 20. We're going to be a flight level 260, you know, in our end number.
Right.
And those guys get real busy. Like this last summer, they had about Minneapolis Center. We're talking. They had about 20 different mapping companies that were calling them every day. So it gets confusing for them. Yeah, they hate it.
But there's a lot more to this than just getting in the plane and flying.
Yeah, there's a lot of stuff
that went on once.
A lot of pre-planning before that. Yeah, because like I said, we'll get the. Like say this, let's just take the NAEP program for example. We know we're going to do in the state of South Dakota. They give us, our client will give us the blocks, the shape file, the area we're doing. And then our flight planning department will flight plan it.
Huh.
And which, you know, takes time for the parameters that we're going to do, altitude, speed, and all that. And then, you know, if that's how they do that, then we have a simulator in the office that runs it.
Okay.
It'll run, so we can have a build airplane simulate to make sure, because sometimes the flight planning system can get kind of messed up and your lines will get screwed up. We want to make sure all the lines are good.
Or actually straight.
Straight.
Yeah, yeah. You see most lines are 80 miles long.
Yeah, 80 miles long.
Yeah.
And, you know, because it's funny because those longer lines, the earth curves a little bit, so they kind of skew off a little bit.
Yeah.
So it's kind of interesting. So.
Yeah. Huh. That's cool. And 80 miles doing 350 knots is not very long.
Well, those lines can take us 15, 20 minutes sometimes.
Okay.
At that altitude. So it's long enough.
Yeah.
You feel like you're flying straight for a long time.
I'm just saying, when I was doing that marine mammal survey, we had a lot of triangular shaped things, so some lines would be like 10 miles long, and other ones would be, you know, 190, and we're doing 100 knots. So you'd be on straight, going straight forever.
Yeah, the thing is, when you're up at that altitude, it's like you could be going north-south lines, you'll be going like 350 knots one way, and you'll be going like maybe 200 the other direction.
Okay, so you've got that, the winds are going to
be different. Yeah, the wind will get you, you know, it's fast going one way, slow going, but it all adds up.
And that doesn't matter for the camera at all.
No, our digital cameras, like I said, they can keep up. We can't go, the higher you go, the faster you can go.
Right.
But we've never had a problem. The actual system, well, if you're going too fast, we plan a target speed for the job, and the computer system on the airplane will let you know when you're going too fast, and you tell you to slow down. But the lower you go, the slower we have to go.
Is that a target ground speed or a target?
It's target ground speed.
Okay, because the camera doesn't care about your airspeed, it just cares about movement across the ground. Huh, cool. All right, let's go move on to like what you look for in pilots. You've got how many pilots work for you?
Right now, there's only two of us. we have a contract guy we bring on in the summer, usually.
Okay.
But right now, we just have enough work where we only need two.
Okay. So that if you got a bunch of contracts, you might pull in and try to find extra people.
Yeah. And it's kind of hard because, I mean, you can teach someone how to do mapping.
Right.
Some people can't do it. I mean, I've seen people who can't do it, but it's once you get the hang of it, it's easy. But sometimes people can't have a hard time getting on and off the lines. You know,
right.
It seems easy, but it's not when you're up there.
Yeah, no, actually, again, the marine mammal survey, and Andy, the guy that I was flying that with, that was a big thing when he sort of like, how do you do the turn back on?
Mm-hmm.
Of course, I was like, come on, Andy, I can't get myself back on a straight line.
Yeah, but, some people just, it doesn't work in their head. It's like flying an ILS all day long. You'll be able to fly an ILS all day long,
right?
Essentially.
When you also want to be able to have a consistent pattern to get back on lines, you don't want to be goofing around and people back wonder what you're doing.
Yeah, sometimes you miss it. Sometimes I miss it too, because you can't, your first line up there, you really don't know what the winds are. You can have a really strong wind at 260 that's going to push you through the line. You got to turn around and do it again. Because there's a certain start point where the camera's going to turn on. You got to be straight and level at that point.
And then you really got to hold it for the whole line.
Yeah.
And plus, like you said, you're flying a Conquest, and just insurance-wise, you're not going to get just any pilot to jump into the Conquest.
Yeah, our requirements are pretty high, just because our insurance company, it's on our website, I'm not sure if they are, but we're not going to take a, you know, $500 multi-engine pilot,
right.
Put that way.
Yeah.
It's just, that's the way it is. I mean, not to mention our equipment, we have pretty big equipment.
Expensive.
And expensive equipment, we have expensive equipment, so the cameras are multi-million dollar things.
Yeah, you're saying the cameras are more expensive than the airplane.
Yeah, I mean, this is the first time I've flown planes that, well, the Conquest is about the same model as much as the camera is. I mean, most planes you fly, like the little single-engine Cessnas, they have the cameras a lot more than the airplane.
Right, yeah. Well, even this we're talking about, we're looking at the camera hole that you put in these planes. Mm-hmm. And since they're pressurized airplanes, so it's got the pressure vessel has to stay intact. So it's like, what did you say, 300,000 to put a hole in?
Yeah, the conversion is about 300,000, 250,000, 300,000 depending on the airplane to
put
hole, because they got basically all engineering involved. You got to dig through all the control cables, anything that's through the floorboards there, you got to move.
Right, yeah.
Sometimes the flat motor, like we had a flat motor issue with the one airplane because it was a different conversion of the flaps.
That's right. And the glass has to be optical quality.
It's optical quality glass. It's very expensive glass. And because you have to be able to shoot through it, not have any glare.
Right, yeah.
So there's all that involved. It's expensive. It usually takes, it depends on where you get it done, but it usually takes about 3 or 4 months, the whole process, to put a hole in an airplane. So if you have any work, you're missing a plane for 3 or 4 months.
Right, yeah. And you have 3 airplanes, so you have some options.
Yeah.
You can have one down getting retrofitted for something. Mm-hmm. And you said the cameras, switching them back and forth is that easy, so you're keeping that one for 20.
We try to keep the point in each camera and each airplane, and not move them around, because they said that a lot of wires, cabling, and when you unhook and hook things up, it's just a computer. Sometimes don't always work, and try to figure out why it's not working now. But that's the way it is. I mean, nothing's perfect yet,
Right, yeah. So when you're in a downtime now between projects, you go into the office on a Monday, and because you've got a... You're not just the pilot. You also have other responsibilities.
Yeah, this time of year, it's a lot of people. I mean, there's still guys doing imaging processing and stuff like that. Right now, I don't have a whole lot to do right now. Try to keep myself busy, going over to the airplane manuals. And I keep track of all the maintenance, so we get maintenance for each airplane. So I got all the maintenance books back there. I try to make sure everything's in order. And we get... So we're getting, our planes are getting annuals and maintenance right now on our downtime, so I keep trying to make sure everything's, all the logbooks and everything are in order. Make sure we got all the charts ready for the next couple of jobs. Because we do have jobs on the books, just not until next month or December or whatever. So we know what we're doing. I just try to make sure everything's in the flight department's ready to go when the time comes.
Right. And do you have a season? It's like summertime, your season, or not really?
Not really. We pretty much go year round, but like I said, the summer season is that National Agricultural Imagery Program. That's big. We do that. That's a summer job.
Right.
But we're pretty much steady throughout the year with, we can't shoot imagery with snow.
Okay.
So we're not gonna, in the winter we don't go
to North Dakota.
But also another thing, I was talking about that sun angle. We had a job in Minneapolis that we had to do for the U.S. Department of, or USGS. The weather didn't allow us to get up there. And we didn't get it done, and from, I don't know, it was like November until whenever, the sun never gets above 30 degrees up there.
Right,
so
right.
We had to wait till spring to go do it.
Yeah, because you just can't do it.
Uh-huh. We were on other projects doing stuff. We couldn't get up there, and we just ran out of time with that, so.
Right, they understand.
We do stuff, there's stuff in Florida we do year-round, and, we go to Texas a lot, do stuff out there.
Okay. What do you know about international work like this? Have you guys thought about doing that, or?
We've bid on projects. I mean, I don't know if we've bid on them, but there's a lot of international out there.
You've got enough work in the U.S.
There's a lot of things involved that we're kind of a small company right now as far as getting customs and getting a plane there. I mean, I've been to Puerto Rico a couple of times, not with this company, but doing jobs down there.
I think getting that equipment through customs is actually can be a big deal.
Well, that's another thing that. On the cameras, that inertial measurement unit. I said that's a missile warhead guidance system. There's a lot of defense paperwork you got to fill out. Now they're pretty okay with it.
Right.
But you got to just make sure you got all the papers in order.
Right. Yeah.
They don't want to see that. That's hard. And there are a lot of other companies that there's some companies in Europe that probably fly all over the place too. And I know companies. There's one company I know that has a plane constantly in South America. Doing this work.
Well, that's when I was doing marine mammal surveys in the Aleutians, there was a Dash 8, an Australian Dash 8 that came up, and they were doing ocean. They were mapping the bottom of the ocean through the Aleutian chain. But they had to wait till right condition. They actually didn't fly that much, but we were jealous because, a Dash 8, they had a bathroom on board.
Yeah, and there's a big. There's another part of the survey that I'm not too familiar with, where they do look for minerals and stuff like that.
Oh, yep.
There's a Dash 7. There's a company out there called Fugro. They're a really big international company that does a lot of survey, among other things, too. They've got a Dash 7 that they're flying around.
I like Dash 7.
And it's got a I'll send you a picture. It's got wires that go from the nose to the wings to the tail.
Huh.
It's like a diamond around it. And then they've got two buoys that are they reel out, trail behind the airplane. Sensors or something.
Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, that's part of the survey I'm not familiar with. Yeah, but I know it happens a lot. It's mostly up in Canada and overseas where they do that.
So next time you see a weird airplane with a bunch of stuff, I just saw a Casa 212 in Iceland, actually, that had these two booms coming off the nose. had to have been a survey of some
sort.
Yeah,
that was Fugro's that airplane. I think it probably had the things on the...
I think you're right. I think that's what it said on the tail.
Yeah.
I'll look at the picture.
Fugro, I think it is. Yeah, Fugro's got one of those.
Yeah, because I remember thinking, well, that's a weird name for
a company. They do caravans, too, at other airplanes. They have a big boom that hangs off the back. Like,
okay.
It's about this big. It's big.
Huh. Yeah, that's funny. I think that's exactly who that was. I didn't see the wires, but I didn't get that close.
They might have had them up there, but they do have it. I'll send you the link. I'll show you all that stuff.
It's yeah, cool. Yeah. Excellent. All right. Well, I think, do you have anything else you'd like to add? Anything you can think of? Or, I mean, you're home a fair amount.
Yeah.
So many flying jobs, you're gone. So yeah. If you've got a family, this isn't a bad job.
No, I mean, it'd be nice to have a schedule because it's hard to some of my clients say, hey, you want to go to a concert next month? It's like, I don't know, can I? I've been doing this for like 6 years now, so I'm kind of used to it. But I would love to, I mean, there are other companies out there that have schedules, but not...
This works
not,
for you.
Yeah. I mean, it's okay. And like I said, I'm at home a lot more than I was. I was an airline pilot, I know that. It's just, when is it going to be, pretty much.
But right.
Like I said, other than the summer... That summer job, I know I'm probably going to be gone for the summer, most of the summer. I'm home probably 90% of the time.
Okay.
It's really not.
And you're on a salary, so you're not worried.
Yeah, salary, which is nice.
Yeah, it's not like you're worried about whether that next worth's going to come to pay the bills.
Yeah.
Cool. Excellent. Well, yeah, send those links on when you get a chance. And, yeah, I'm sure I'll put something on the network about this first, and then we'll get this on the main website later on. And
cool.
You may get questions on the network, I'd imagine.
It's fine.
That's slowly, slowly kind of turning, getting more interesting. But cool, excellent. Well, thanks for sitting down.
We hope you liked this interview. If you found it useful, visit oddballpilot.com for more stuff like it.